Hi again, grifters. Welcome to the second half of the special two-part edition of the Leverage 10 podcast. Last week, we featured the first half of a Q&A panel that followed a screening of Leverage's episode 405, The Van Gogh Job, for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. The panel was hosted by me, Kayla Dobson, and featured co-creators and executive producers of Leverage, John Rogers and Chris Downey, executive producer Dean Devlin, and Academy Award-winning actor and our very own Nate Ford, Timothy Hutton. We hope you enjoy the second half of our panel discussion.
Talking about, you know, truth behind Leverage. Dean, you kind of mentioned this before. Do you think the current economic climate and political climate has to do with what makes Leverage so relevant to audiences today? I know that a lot of what you guys portray on Leverage mirrors real life and things like that. So do you think the economic climate has anything to do with why our fan base is so supportive?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's exacerbated now because we're in a tough economy and there's a lot of people to be mad at. But, you know, Robin Hood has been a story that always works, you know, because I think that a lot of us feel like we're powerless. And the idea that that there could be a gang of high-tech, brilliant thieves who could come to your aid, pretty cool idea. I'd like to call the Leverage team at least twice a week. Yeah. When my cable guy doesn't show up, could you?
It seems an unwieldy application of a team of grifters. A cable guy, really?
Using a nuclear weapon in a
kind of a hammer. Yeah. It is amazing how many times, as we develop stories, we go to the network and the network goes, "Wow, it's a little over the top. No one would do this," and we have to say we toned it down. This person is actually far more awful than anything we've shown in the episode. Man's capacity to be a jerk in quest of his own enrichment is. I have to admit, after 5 years of this show, different human being. There's just no way around it.
I think that's why people started watching the show. I think the reason that people keep coming back season after season is because they love the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think ultimately, you know, if it was a show where they are hunting murderers or, you know, a more conventional television show, I think it's testament to our actors and the love that the audience has for them that they would be tuning in, I mean, you know, season after season.
You're playing a functional alcoholic who's really an unpleasant human being. and as you would say, you're playing me. But but I mean, that's great. That Nate Ford is Nate Ford. You want to watch Nate Ford, who is a really unpleasant guy, be unpleasant to even more unpleasant guys. I mean, the fact you've managed to make him likable and make him a hero is, you know, we don't write him that way. You make them charming.
No, but the other thing that happened was the way this show is cast. I mean, who could have thought that these five people would, you know, like each other as much as we ended up and play off of each other and go off script, pardon me, sometimes. No, but I mean, they're wonderful because they encouraged it in Chicago on the pilot.
Yeah.
Just little beats that would happen at the end of scenes and stuff. Just something that happened when the five of us got together the first time and did the first scene. You know, we could feel it. We could feel that there was... Yeah,
don't fight for the line. The rule is always give us one that's the way it is and then just get it on the carrier deck. It doesn't have to be pretty. Just get it there in the most interesting way. And I think a good part of being a showrunner is shutting up and letting the actors find the characters. And it's kind of heretical as writers to say that, but so much of the writing for the 5 years has been, wow, I didn't know that person felt that way about that person. You know, I didn't know that look was going to arrive. And that's created stories. The character of your father, played by Tom Skerritt.
Jimmy Ford,
was born entirely of a look that Tim Hutton gave to a stool. There was an idea that the stool was the place his father sat all the time at this bar. And at the end of the episode, in our heads, he was dead. He was gone. And at the end of the episode, Tim threw this look over just like, I just hate that son of a bitch. That was everything in that look. And it was just a throwaway. And the whole writing staff watching the first draft went, oh, we got to have that guy show up now. Because Nate Ford hates that guy. And he became a big part of the show.
Well, he could be, yeah, Tom Skerritt.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, can you talk a little bit about what it's been like seeing your ragtag crew of thieves gradually become a family? And are there any similarities between the Leverage crew's interpersonal relationships and the actors' relationships?
No. I mean, it's been incredible. I mean, to do something like this, now it's the fifth year. We all started together in the pilot in Chicago, and everyone came from these different places, just like the crew, just like the Leverage crew. Difference is they're all dysfunctional, none of us are.
oh
It really has become a family, and we genuinely love seeing each other every morning and starting the day out together. And we read the scripts and we say, "Oh, I get to do a scene with a couple of scenes with Beth," or you know, Aldis gets excited when he's able to work with Gina. Gina and I like working together. It, all these different combinations that the guys come up with. And then when we get to do a five-hander, when all five of us are doing a scene, we just have the best time. It's a very spirited set. We do come to each other with, you know, thoughts about the story and character and ideas we might want to try in a scene. And we also come to each other about life stuff. We really have become kind of a family, kind of a team in our own way.
I know a lot of shows, you know, they say that, you know, oh, our show's a family, our show's, you hear it a lot. What Tim's talking about is really kind of unusual, and he's right. It started in Chicago, and then the first season was shot in L.A., and it almost started to dissipate a little bit because everyone had all these other things to do. And then when we moved up to Portland, it really solidified again. And I give a lot of this credit to Tim because, you know, when you have a lead in a show like this, it can go south or it can be heaven. And Tim has been like such a cheerleader, not just for the other actors, but for the crew, for... You know, if I've done a good episode, he calls me up and compliments. I mean, he takes time out of his day to tell people, you know, when they're hitting it right, and to encourage them. And like when guest performers are there and they're struggling, you know, he's the first person to encourage them. And it sets a tone, you know, because if your lead is supportive, it's hard for egos to grow elsewhere because. If the main guy ain't causing a fit, you look pretty silly if you start doing it. And Tim's led from day one in Chicago.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you built your team, not just the Leverage team, but you know the crew, the cast? What did you do to create such a family?
Well, you know, the thing is, what goes on screen is really important, but what happens off screen, I think, is even more important because this is how we live our lives. You know, I had an argument with a director a long time ago. I won't say who it was, but he said to me, "Bad set, good movie." He said every time he had a set where everyone hated each other, the movie was fantastic, and all that conflict came onto the screen. And I said, "Well." That hasn't been my personal experience. My personal experience is my happiest sets were my best work. I said, but let's just say that it was science, that it was scientifically proven that bad set, good movie. I'd rather make mediocre work because I got to live my life. So when we put this together, it's not just who's the best actor, who's the best writer, it's who do I want to spend my life with? Because I'm going to spend a big chunk of my life with these people. So I've been fortunate enough to get the best of both worlds, the most talented people I've ever worked with, and people I really love spending time with. And you know, we like to say making our show is being in the bubble, because it's so not like the rest of our industry. And then every once in a while, someone will get a job on another show or do something, and they always come back going, "I want back in the bubble. It's safe in the bubble." And it has to do with this amazing group of humans. We're kind of like repertory theater, you know. John was talking about Gary Camp, our A operator. Gary has done almost every single thing I've made since 1991. One of our top directors has worked with me since 1991. Connell's been with me for 10 years. You know, all the people on our show tend to stick together. And it ain't because I pay a lot, because I don't pay for crap. So it has to be because it's fun. And that's what we try to do, is make a fun set, make being in this business pleasurable.
That makes sense. And kind of following up on that and talking about Leverage as a whole and how your career has kind of influenced Leverage. It's not technically a genre show itself, but it does have a large following among, you know, genre-specific audience, you know, specifically sci-fi, things like that. And Dean, you pretty much are the master of genre. So how do you think your background factors into your approach to Leverage and Leverage as a whole?
First of all, not a Renaissance man. I'm not the master of the genre. There's guys way better at this than me. But what I am is someone who actually really enjoys this stuff. You know, a lot of times, you know, you'll hear about a movie or a TV show, and somehow your spidey senses just feel like you could hear the meeting where they said, people will really like this, as opposed to the people who are making it really like it. You know, I watch, like when I watch Doctor Who or Sherlock out of the UK, I know the people who make that love it. And I can feel their love in that show. I don't think I'm in the same league as those guys, but where I am in the same league is that I love this kind of entertainment as much as they do. And as much as I can get my passion into that, then maybe some of that can be infectious. And I'm proud to say that everyone I work with really truly likes this kind of work. And it's not, oh, well, that's a paycheck, so I can go do something else. This is a very specific thing, and when done right, it's beautiful. We all work to get there.
I'm pretty sure I'm the only executive producer on a television show where I'll get a call, the head of the studio would like to see you. Oh, God, and I walk in next building, I go inside, and you interrupt my workday, walk in, and he goes, did you see Sherlock last night? Oh, my God! Like, that, breaking a show. No, you have to look at this. I mean, it is. It's everyone on the show loves this type of show, you know? Such a fanboy, you really are. It's a little embarrassing.
Yeah, except for I'm not the one who wrote a book on Dungeons and Dragons.
No. I wrote a
comic book about Dungeons and Dragons.
Thanks.
And then I may have written an article for the 30th anniversary. I'm playing tomorrow if you want to come.
Well then, John and Chris, how do you think your backgrounds have kind of factored into the genre approach to Leverage?
Well, you defended White Collar Scum, so why don't you start with that?
This is my third career. I was a journalist, and then I was a defense attorney, as John said, defending White Collar Scum. I defended a lot of insider trading, Wall Street guys. So certainly, I've drawn on a lot of personal experiences. No clients that I defended or actually depicted on the show in any way.
Actually, that was what became what is shorthanded in the room as the evil speech of evil, which is the moment in the episode where the villain gets to explain to someone why he is actually the most reasonable person in the world. Yeah. And it's actually really important to keep these guys from getting cartoony because nobody thinks they're Lex Luthor. They're just a businessman who has Superman in the way of him doing business. And that's all they wind up having.
In the season opener this year, I have to tell you, when the evil speech of evil happens, it actually happens early in that episode. Usually it's at near the end. In the season opener, it happens very early in it. And there's a shot of Tim. There's a shot of Tim right as the guy's reaching the height of the evil speech of evil. And the shot just pushes in just slightly on Tim's face. And you just know, oh, I'm so going to bring you down. Yeah. I'm so going to have to take you off that pedestal. It's one of my favorite moments.
I was going to hurt you. Not gonna have to. Yeah. And for me, it was those 60 shows. I always say if Leverage was on television, if television were one long show, like one long week, we'd be on Friday nights between It Takes a Thief and Rockford Files. Yeah. Like that's really, and that's why I started working with Dean a long time ago now. God, is because I kept looking for these types of things to write, and kind of grim and gritty was in, and he was the only guy at the time kind of still making, like the librarian thing is the first thing. I wrote a movie for you, but the librarian is the first thing we did. And it was like, oh, yes, action, adventure, a couple jokes, things blow up, banter, yay, you know? I like that. And you were the only one, so I'm stuck with you.
Well, Tim, you talked a little bit about your approach to Nate in this episode, but I was kind of wondering if you could give us some insight in how you approached Nate when Leverage first started, when you first were introduced to the character.
Well, it was kind of great because, I mean, the guy was pretty much lost everything, his wife, his job, his kid, just terrible set of circumstances. So there was really only one way out, and that was up. So the pilot script starts off with him, kind of drunk in a bar, missing his flight or something, and some guy approaches him and asks him to do something he would never consider. But he's kind of at a place where he has to, and that's how it started. So as a starting point for a character, it was pretty great. Nowhere to go but up, lost everything, angry, willing to do it, nothing to lose, willing to get killed, willing to kill practically. a lot of unfinished business, a lot of things that, that he needed to, that this person needed to kind of resolve. So, you know, and then, you know, these guys were so amazing. I knew that they were going to take the character and, you know, in all these amazing places and then talk about what happened with his son, talk about what happened to his wife and his job, where the world, the corporate world that he came from and all the corruption that he saw and a need to settle the score, this idea that the only way he could help himself was to help others. And it was just a really interesting place to start a character.
I'm kind of following up on that. There were a lot of firsts in our pilot episode. Dean, you directed our pilot. Can you talk a little bit about what it is about Leverage that made you want to venture into directing?
Well, I liked the script so much, I didn't want to let anyone else direct it. I mean, it's that selfish. I hate to say it, but you just don't get to see material that good that often. You know, I've wanted to direct for a long time, but I never found a project that I thought, you know, I've got to do that. And when I got John and Chris's script, it's like you couldn't pry it out of my hands. You know, I've written myself, and one of the hardest things I think there is to do is to exposit character on the fly. In other words, while you're off trying to do something else and exposit the character. And I have to say, I've been lazy as a writer. You know, when I want you to feel good about a character, you know, I'll literally stop the movie and show him putting a flower on a grave or something, you know, begging for sympathy for the character. And John and Chris would put this stuff right in the middle of an action scene. There'd be this character beat that made me completely understand the character. You know, because we had all discussed what the character was going to be beforehand, but I didn't know until I saw the script that my tough guy on the show, my, you know, the muscle in the show, was going to say, "I don't like guns." And when I saw that in the script, I thought, okay, now this is going to be fun. And they've now just thrown this giant challenge. Because if you got a tough guy and he can pull a gun out, drama. If he can't pull a gun out, you got to be clever. You got to be really smart on how this guy does stuff, because it has to stay believable and it has to stay fun. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, I want to shoot that scene. I want to shoot the scene where this guy takes five guys out and he has no weapons. That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
What time did you decide to put us on a roof in October? on the 44th story on a roof in October?
Well, it's not like Chicago is known for being windy.
When was that? I always want to know what the decision-making process was. Because when we wrote that, Parker hangs off the 44th story of a Chicago skyscraper. We thought, well, green screen. And the production designer thought, green screen. And Dean said, well, we're plainly building something on the roof of a skyscraper. And if you go back and watch the pilot, we're 44 up. And there's no railings, no nothing. We built a fake
and
wall up there.
That's Beth Riesgraf.
That's Beth Riesgraf, yeah. Hanging in that harness. Yeah.
And the worst part of it is, it is real. And everyone thinks it's green screen.
I know.
So I kind of thought afterwards, all right, next time maybe we'll just do green screen. But it was kind of amazing. And the day we were supposed to shoot it, we couldn't because there were 30-mile-an-hour winds. And we got up there and like the whole set, because we'd built a set on the roof of the building. And it starts to like, okay, so if this shears off and falls down, that could be bad. So we set everything out, we locked it down. The next day, which was our last day of shooting, if we couldn't have shot it then, we would have been, you know, out of luck. So the last day of shooting, the wind had died down, and we went to go shoot it. And, you know, we had to have Beth hanging upside down on this rig on the top of this building. And as John said, there's no railing on the roof. So as we're walking up, John is saying to Beth, you know, it's going to be okay. I know this sounds scary. It's going to be fine. You know, I'm coming up there with you. We're going to see this. And we walked out. And as soon as John walked out on the roof, he grabbed hold of the doorway and went, no, I can't go out there.
I am being the most condescending guy you can imagine. The whole way up the stairs, like, now, miss, we're not going to, first time I met her, like, we're not going to put you in any danger. Don't worry about that. We get out there, and Riesgraf's literally, there's no railing. It's 44 stories. And she's like, I'm fine. And I am wrapped around a post like a five-year-old who just saw Santa die, just screaming, like, get me off this roof, in the name of God. And she held my hand and took me back downstairs. Turns out I'm terrified of heights. Who knew? I'm not terrified of most heights, but 44 stories up with no railing, yeah, that.
Well, I think our audience is enjoying these kind of stories. So before we wrap up, I'd like to go ahead and start addressing some of these audience questions that we have. Thank you to our audience members for writing these questions. So this is to all of you. Will you continue with experimental style episodes in the upcoming seasons?
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, we've got a bunch. I mean, the great thing about the show is that, you know, we talked about genres. I mean, every episode we can do a different genre with the format of the show. I mean, this, what you just saw, was a historical romance. This coming season we've got a political satire. We've got
another historical.
We've got another sports episode. We've got another historical episode, and we've got one that is and the writer is in the audience here. Jeff, I'm talking to you. That's as far out there, I think, as we've done. I mean, it's pretty. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, we just saw the first cut. It's amazing. It's the dream one, and it's just it's incredible. And that is the fun of it. Is also, we get directors coming in like, can I do this? Yeah, give it a shot. Rip it up. Stay on pattern. Stay under budget. Yeah. You can do whatever you want. And you know, that's, again, freedom that Dean gives here. That's not, you don't get from a studio full of humans. So now we've got a lot of really odd ones coming your way this year, including another split one, which we did last year. Last year we split Boys' Night and Girls' Night separately. We did the girls, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, kind of the two episodes happening simultaneously in each other's background. This year we split it up, and Tim and Gina are doing a Nick and Nora, classic Nick and Nora adventure, with Mark Sterling, Mark Shepard of Sterling, who's out there somewhere, I believe. It. There you go.
Oh,
and then, and then starting on Wednesday, Dean is directing Christian Bethinaldis in kind of a big sort of action spy thriller. So it's never the same show.
You know, normally on a show, when you get into like the fifth season and you start running out of ideas, they do the hostage episode, you know, where
that was the first one we shot.
Yeah, so we did it up front. So all the Hackney ones, we got out of the way. So now we get to really be out there.
Well, and kind of following up on that, we have another question. How do you come up with a new con every week? It seems like a daunting task.
We just tell Tim, and Tim does it, really. We don't.
We have a pretty broad definition of, you know, there are a handful of classic cons, but our definition of a con is it's a artificial set of circumstances that are designed to get somebody to do something. And if we can, and that kind of gives you pretty wide latitude, you know, whether we're gaslighting somebody, whether we're kind of leading them through a mystery that we've created. You know, we've done 77 of these, and John's talked about this. We are the longest running con and heist show
in American television.
And, you know, I think by having that broad definition of con, we're really able to take things in a lot of different directions.
And that comes from Apollo Robbins, who's our thief consultant. We actually have a consultant who runs a crew of reformed thieves and grifters, consults with law enforcement. And he's come up, and he comes to the show and gives us a lot of stuff. And he says all a con is convincing someone they want something that's just on the other side of a bad decision. And if that's your decision, then all you have to do is create the set of circumstances. It's right there, man. Just find out what you want. And it was fun because, you know, the first year we're like, God, we're learning all these rules about how crimes and cons work. And fourth year he came up and sat in the room and watched us break a story. And he's like, you're now an official crime crew. The writing staff could now commit these crimes. You're well-trained enough. You could go out and steal enormous amounts of money. So we actually did one story where Chris has a friend who's a U.S. attorney, and to check the details on it, he called him and said, we're running this con with this, you know, just how bad are we? You know, because on the accurate cool measure, we try to be towards cool, but not totally throwing out accurate. And there was about a 5-minute pause, and the guy goes, that would totally work. Please don't do that episode.
I think we found new ways of money laundering.
We did. We invented it. But that was the jury job. He's like, yeah, that would work. Please change this.
This happens a lot on our show. In fact, last year when we were doing the season finale, we had to hack a dam. And as we were scouting the dam, John turned to the person running the dam and said, well, here's how we're going to take the dam down in the show. Is that realistic? And you should have seen the panic on this guy's face. He was like, oh my God. He hadn't thought of it.
He wrote and declared me a security threat. It was great. Yeah. I wish I had the letter.
I got to make a phone call, one of those.
One of those, I got to make a phone call.
Well, John, this next question is about you. John Rogers has written for comic books, for movies, for TV, and even for role-playing games. How do they influence each other? What's the most fun? What's the most challenging and rewarding?
Comic books are the hardest because you're writing, editing, and directing at the same time. You have to, depending on how you write, you actually have to call every shot. Screenwriting, two people walk into a room, they do a little banter, they leave. It's the director's problem. He's up in Portland. It's not my problem. I'm drinking down in L.A. But comic books, you have to pin it. You know what? All of it's about character. When I was writing Blue Beetle, about Jaime Reyes, who was really DC's only Hispanic superhero at the time, it was just, all right, what's it like to be 15 and have these powers? Leverage each one of these characters. We approach, and each writer has a different feel for the different characters, and we get this feedback loop where we watch the dailies and watch the episodes, and that changes our definition. And so we throw new stuff up, and you guys create like new permutations and new combinations. And I'll fully admit, third or fourth season, there were character relations that we had never anticipated. You know, and a lot of that comes from Dean. You know, it's very easy as a writer to kind of get up inside your own head and cleverness, and Dean is the heart of the show. You know, he'll be the one that comes in as like, sixth act, I need this moment, I need the heart moment, I need the moment where we feel we've vindicated the guy. Not just we've seen we've tricked him, but we feel the guy suffer and we feel the win. But every good story is about somebody wants something and why can't they get it? So it's just whatever storytelling medium you're in, just hold to that. It ain't rocket science. No, sorry, it's incredibly difficult. I forgot. Forgot a WGA, I have to say, it's very hard.
We have a couple questions for Tim, or about Nate's character. Will Nathan Ford plan on settling down, and what do you all see in the future for him?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what I like, there was something about the beginning of this season that I liked very much, where the first time you see him, should I say, should I not?
Yeah, no, it's okay.
He arrives on a small sailboat by himself. So he's been away for 6 months, and he's end of the last episode, season four. He says, "I've got some big changes. I've got some things I want to do. I want to be a different kind of person." So it came to be that he shows up on this sailboat, and there's something about that I like. Like the theme of that, that might kind of go on for a while. Maybe he'll return to that and go somewhere else, but we'll see. I mean, all the characters are kind of finding their way. Just as they've all discovered that they're at their best when they're with each other, there's a change, interesting change that's beginning to happen, where the possibilities of what they might do once they realize they can't always keep doing that becomes a very interesting part of the show.
Well, I'm kind of following up on that. We have a great question. What would you like to see your character challenged with in future scripts?
Sobriety?
That's not going to work for us.
That's not going to work. You know, I think, to go on what I was just saying, his family, I mean, he lost his family. He lost everything that was important to him. And he'd be the last person to admit it, but these people, Hardison and Elliot and Sophie and Parker, they become his family. So I think the challenge for him now is to understand, again, back on that theme, that he needs to do something. He needs to go somewhere. He needs to figure it out. He needs to have something that resembles perhaps something different, and also needs to let go. It's not just what he needs to move toward. It's the need to help them maybe move towards something that will, change for the better their lives, because it can't keep going. So the beauty of that, of course, is that it all goes to hell and they fall back with each other, I hope.
I actually say one of the nicest things we ever had is one of the TNT execs we were talking about this year, and he said, you know, what's remarkable? Tim Hutton's never played the same character 2 years in a row. And it's it. You really, like, you know, Nate's been a different guy every year. And people change over time, and that's been to a great degree. I'm just writing the same angry drunk. I mean, you're really you're really moving him.
Well, it's because of these the conditions that he's put in. I mean, the characters, the challenges, the challenging way that the rest of the crew approach him and reproach him about his behavior and where he's going. Yeah, I think everybody's kind of had that. I mean, if you look at the Elliot character the first year, where it is now, that's been kind of an interesting journey with the show. But Yeah, there's a lot of interesting storytelling left with all of the characters.
Well, that makes me want to tune in for season 5. So that's it for our audience questions, and that about wraps up our panel for the evening. Thank you so much to our audience for their wonderful questions.
Well, grifters, that's it for this special edition of the Leverage 10 podcast featuring the Q&A panel discussion of Leverage 405, the Van Gogh job for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Don't forget to tune into the new season of Leverage Sundays at 8 p.m. only on TNT. Thanks again, grifters.
Don't forget, grifters, you can download the new Season 5 episodes from iTunes after they air, as well as all your old favorites, and be sure to check out the new Leverage Series Companion eBook, available for download on the iTunes Store.